mull over what we've done, if we really commit to examining both our own actions and the actions of those around us, we can eventually come to understand what's too little, what's too much, and what's just right. We need to know it when we see it, and we'll only know it when we see it if we're always looking for it. This search for virtue can help us in other ways, too. Once we start thinking of people as collections of these qualities, we can better understand what we like and don't like about them. Sometimes we'll say, Luis is the nicest guy, or Diana is the sweetest person in the world, but we don't actually want our friends to be extreme. The actual nicest person in the world would be so boring. Think of people you once spent a lot of time with, ex-boyfriends or girlfriends, maybe. The things you loved about them were probably the qualities that were so balanced that they approached virtues.
Damon was always there for me, but he also knew when I needed some time to myself.
The things that drove you nuts about them, that probably turned them into exes, were the qualities in which they were wildly deficient or excessive, and which they never seemed to modify in order to get closer to that balance you desired.
Damon never used deodorant, and clipped his toenails on the dining room table, and cleaned the Cheeto dust off his fingers by wiping them on my cat.
Also, importantly, realize that those people are thinking the same things about you. It's probably not hard to remember a time when someone hit a breaking point with you over some deficiency or excess of a quality that you suffer from. Yeah, that time you got dumped is suddenly making more sense now, right? We can find these golden means only by practicing the art of finding them, by trying and failing and trying and failing, and by evaluating those successes and failures. Golden means, they make you less annoying. So now, at long last, we can loop all the way back to our original question and provide a sturdier answer. We might have instinctively known that it's bad to punch our friend in the face for no reason, but now we understand why it's bad. Instead of exhibiting the mean of a virtue, mildness, it demonstrates a wildly excessive amount of anger. That seesaw would be way out of balance. We now also understand how to behave going forward. We may have been inclined toward mildness, understanding intuitively, thanks to a mildness starter kit, that mild is a good thing to be. But if we don't practice mildness, if we don't learn how to fine-tune it and regularly check in with ourselves about whether what we're doing is appropriately mild, we might someday end up drooling while other kids get bullied or punching our friends in the face. Virtue ethics gives us the whole picture, how we're doing, how we can get better, and what we should avoid. Let's revisit my own personal example with the virtue of dutifulness, which, again, isn't among those listed by Aristotle. We might say that the deficiency of dutifulness would be lawlessness, just breaking all rules and social contracts. The excess of dutifulness would be mindless obedience, the kind exhibited by soldiers committing atrocities because they were only following orders. My personal relationship to dutifulness has at times tipped toward excess. Just ask my wife, my friends, or anyone who was at a college party with me right after the noise curfew hit. I rinse my mouth with mouthwash for 30 full seconds because that's what it says to do on the label. I drive with my hands at 10 and 2 on the wheel because that's what my driving instructor told me to do. I've always seen this behavior as virtuous and written off annoyed reactions to it as unfounded, but after I read Aristotle, I understood how an excess of dutifulness can negatively impact the people around me. Basically, I am constantly killing everyone's buzz. The look on my wife's face when she tries to talk to me and then realizes she has to wait 30 full seconds for me to finish my mouthwash routine would melt steel. I've tried hard in the last few years to demilitarize my overabundant dutifulness, but it ain't easy. I'm 46 years old and I've lived this way all my life. I haven't been looking for that golden mean and thus, I can be kind of annoying. But again, I'm not a lost cause. I was born with a good starter kit for the virtue of dutifulness, which relentlessly warned me against violating rules. I essentially did everything my parents and teachers told me to do because they were in charge. Now, however, if someone in a position of authority told me to do something iffy, I wouldn't just blindly obey, even if that person were wearing a uniform with a name tag that said, Official Rulemaking Authority Guy. Oof, even thinking about that guy makes me nervous. I might not have practiced finding the golden mean as much as I should have, but at least I now have a greater understanding of the world. I have knowledge about social interactions and a sense of propriety and wisdom shared with me by a bunch of wise men and women, all of which help me modulate my inclination to follow rules. If I had relied solely on my starter kit for my whole life, things could have turned out very badly. Given my predilection to do what I'm told, I'm lucky that the circumstances of my upbringing pushed me only to a mild excess of dutifulness that made me kind of annoying, and not an extreme excess that made me, you know, a war criminal. To me, this is the true value of Aristotle's virtue ethics. Despite being written so long ago, it's really on point when it comes to this one aspect of the human condition. If we're not careful, our personalities and habits slowly and inevitably calcify over time. Until I was about 30, I was an avid music listener in multiple genres. Then I got married and had kids and disappeared from the culture for a while, and now all I listen to is the same late 90s indie rock and hip-hop albums over and over. They are familiar and comforting, and playing them in my car has become an automatic response. Our behaviors create deep grooves in our personalities, like a heavy chair forming impressions in a shaggy rug, and it becomes harder and harder to escape them. The best thing about Aristotle's constant learning, constant trying, constant searching is what results from it: a mature, yet still pliable person, brimming with experiences both old and new, who doesn't rely solely on familiar routines or dated information about how the world works. Aristotle scholar Julia Annis, who is a professor at the University of Arizona, wrote a book called Intelligent Virtue, in which she talks about the difference between a rote response to some situation that tests our virtues and a deeper, more intelligent one.
The result of practicing something is a speed and directness of response comparable to that of mere habit, but unlike it in that the lessons learned have informed it and rendered it flexible and innovative.
What a wonderful idea that when we practice a virtue over and over and over, we become fluent in that virtue, and our responses emerge from a deep reservoir of understanding about the virtue. So instead of remaining stuck in a rut defined by our previous behaviors, we have a fighting chance to make a good decision regardless of how weird the situation might be. Because again, most ethical questions aren't as easy to answer as, should I punch my friend in the face for no reason? They're far more nuanced and complex, so it stands to reason that the harder we've studied, the better we'll fare when some entirely new situation arises to test our moral reflexes. This flexibility of response is actually a bit like comedic acting. There are plenty of skilled comedians in the world who are funny and sharp and have good timing. But others, often coming from improvisational comedy backgrounds, seem more thoroughly funny. They're effortlessly funny in every direction all the time. They never strain or flail or panic, even when they have no script to work from or rehearsal to prepare with. I suspect this is because improv requires intense and constant training. Small groups of people perform together, day in and day out, inventing scenes out of thin air. It teaches them how to be attentive and loose, confident, unrushed, how to calmly focus on all of the quickly moving parts of a scene at once, and to anticipate each other's actions and to avoid repeating themselves. I remember having this thought about Steve Carell and Amy Poehler. I know, I'm name-dropping here, but the analogy is worth it. I promise I will keep the Hollywood celebrity references to a minimum. It's what my very good friend Maya Rudolph would want me to do. I had the thought that they knew their characters so well that The Office or Parks and Recreation writers could place them in any scenario, at any moment, and they would instantly know how to be funny. They were fluent in their characters. They had practiced the skill of comedy so much, so often, for so long, that their responses to any unfolding scenario were flexible and innovative. This is the full sales pitch for virtue ethics. If we really work at finding the means of our virtues, learning their ins and outs, their vicissitudes and pitfalls, their pros and cons, we become flexible, inquisitive, adaptable, and better people. In fact, the search for golden means is cumulative. The closer we get to one, the more it can help us in our search for others. So approaching the mean for kindness helps us get closer to the mean for generosity, which helps us get closer to the mean for loyalty, which helps us approach the mean for temperance, and so on and so on. Eventually, we will truly flourish, achieving a mastery over the exact balances of hundreds of different virtues. We will understand and adapt to any new situation, able to see and decipher the very foundational code of human existence, like Neo at the end of The Matrix. See, being good isn't so hard. You just have to understand the world as completely as Neo does at the end of The Matrix. Needless cruelty, a good thing to avoid. So we now understand why punching our friend in the face for no reason is bad. The person who does that fails to reach, or straight up ignores, the golden mean of several different virtues. But we also started with a deliberately easy question, so let's make a tiny modification. Should we punch our friend in the face if he does something we don't quite like? Maybe this friend made fun of our new khaki shorts, causing us some small pain, and now we have to determine whether we are allowed to punch him in the face. A virtue ethicist would obviously say that a punch to the face after such a minor slight exhibits the same excess of anger that it would have if we were doing it for no reason at all. But we can also look at this from another angle, thanks to Judith Sklar, a Latvian philosopher who wrote extensively about freedom and liberty. Those topics were near and dear to her, given her Jewish family's history. The Sklars had to flee Latvia to escape Stalin, and then had to keep fleeing to escape Hitler, and after finally reaching America, Judith got a PhD from Harvard and became the first woman ever tenured in Harvard's government department. In her masterwork, which is called Ordinary Vices, she makes a compelling argument that cruelty, not pride or envy or wrath or any of the other classic seven deadly sins, is actually the worst human vice, and it should be placed at the top of the list of things to avoid. Here's what she writes.
To put cruelty first is to disregard the idea of sin as it is understood by revealed religion. Sins are transgressions of a divine rule and offenses against God. However, cruelty, the willful inflicting of physical pain on a weaker being in order to cause anguish and fear, is a wrong done entirely to another creature.
When we think only of religious sins as the ultimate bad stuff we want to avoid, we end up manufacturing justifications for horrible atrocities. Her example is the European conquerors coming to the New World, encountering its indigenous peoples, and then rationalizing genocide as the will of a Christian God. If we elevate cruelty, transgressions against other humans, to the top of the worst crimes we can commit list, we can no longer find and exploit any such loopholes. But Sklar has another beef with cruelty, which helps us understand why we shouldn't punch our friend after he makes fun of our khaki shorts. Cruelty, she says, is often way out of proportion to the behavior that prompted it. A man commits a minor crime, like in the famous Les Miserables example, stealing a loaf of bread when you're starving, and he is then sent to prison where his conditions are incredibly cruel. It's asymmetric. The cruelty of the punishment vastly outweighs the crime he has committed. It's a pretty compelling argument, right? The modern-day criminal justice system has put countless people in prison for extremely minor offenses, including some, like marijuana possession, that are now widely legal. But it's not just criminal acts that reveal this problem. Basic, garden-variety human interactions are rife with unwarranted cruelty. If you don't believe me, make a YouTube video and say something innocuous, like, "Cheese is delicious," or, "I love Michigan," and then read the comments.
Go back to East Lansing, you ugly curd-loving moron!
Is just one example of what you might read. Since our goal here is to become better people in our day-to-day lives, putting cruelty first in our list of things to avoid seems like a really good idea. Unfortunately, there is a hefty price to pay. Because there is so much cruelty all around us, thinking of it as humanity's worst vice takes a heavy toll on our psyches. Quote, "If cruelty horrifies us," Sklar writes, "we must, given the facts of daily life, always be in a state of outrage," end quote. And she's right. A quick glance at the news reveals endless cruelty, racism, sexism, voter suppression, laws constructed to keep people in abject poverty, mean YouTube comments. Putting cruelty first threatens to turn us all into misanthropes, says Sklar, which might be why we're tempted not to focus on it. But there is a way to escape the scourge of cruelty. Knowledge, specifically, knowledge of cultural practices other than our own. Quoting the great Enlightenment philosopher Montesquieu, she tells us that, quote, "knowledge makes men gentle, just as ignorance hardens us," end quote. This is an idea Aristotle would like, I think. The more we try to learn and understand the lives being led by other people, the more we search for a golden mean of empathy, the less we will find it permissible to treat them with cruelty. We have covered a lot of ground already. We not only understand that we shouldn't punch our friend in the face for no reason, or for a bad reason, we also have a deeper understanding of why that's true. We know what we're aiming for, golden means of various qualities, and what it provides us, a deep understanding of our actions, rendering us flexible and innovative in their applications to other more complicated situations. We also understand why a cruel action, the wanton infliction of pain on another person, should be at the top of our list of things to avoid. But again, come on. Should we punch our friend in the face for no reason? That was a layup. The world, as we've said, is complicated, and most decisions are not nearly that simple. In fact, what if we're in a situation where our choices are not A, punch someone in the face, or B, don't, but rather A, punch someone in the face, or B, punch someone else in the stomach? What the hell do we do then?
Chapter 2. Should I let this runaway trolley I'm driving kill 5 people, or should I pull a lever and deliberately kill 1 different person?
Weird question, right? I mean, we were just goofing around, talking about Les Miserables and YouTube comments, and suddenly we're in some dystopian vehicular psychodrama. Obviously, chances are you've never been in this exact situation, and you probably never will be. But trust me when I say that any understanding of modern ethical decision-making requires you to think very hard about what you would do if you were faced with this choice, and more importantly, why you would do it. So, you're driving a trolley and the brakes fail. On the track ahead of you are 5 construction workers who will be smushed by the runaway trolley. But there's a lever you can pull that will switch the trolley onto another track, on which is 1 construction worker. The questions are obvious. Should you do nothing, allowing 5 people to be killed? Should you pull the lever, killing 1 person? Also, why are these people working on active trolley tracks in the middle of the day? Who approved this? Was it Jerry from scheduling? That guy is so incompetent. You know he only got this job because his cousin owns the trolley company. This thought experiment, and its many variations, which we'll get to shortly, are collectively called the trolley problem. The original question was posed in 1967 by a British woman named Philippa Foote. Though it wasn't named the trolley problem until Foote's essay was discussed by a woman named Judith Jarvis Thompson, whom we'll meet later and who is largely responsible for many of the maddening variations we're about to investigate. In the annals of trolley problem history, Foote gets all the headlines, but Thompson actually deserves a lot of the attention. Also, Foote was British, so she called it a tram, and the tram problem just doesn't have the same ring to it. Now, I know what you're thinking. Philippa Foot sounds like the name of a fairy tale mouse who lives inside a purple mushroom in an enchanted forest. But she wasn't a fairy tale mouse, she was an esteemed philosopher, and the trolley problem is arguably modern philosophy's most famous thought experiment. In fact, it's so famous and oft discussed that many academics kind of hate it now. They roll their eyes and look annoyed when it comes up because it's all anyone has talked about for 50 years. It's like the philosophy version of Stairway to Heaven or The Godfather or something, an admitted classic that has suffered from overexposure. But suck it up, academic philosophers, we're going to talk about it, because working through its complexities does a bang-up job of explaining why doing the right thing is so difficult. Most people agree that in the original conception, we should pull the lever. We give this answer reflexively. It just kind of seems like the right move. We don't know anything about these people. They're just anonymous construction workers who inexplicably don't find it important to pay attention to the seemingly vital question of whether there might be a trolley bearing down on them. So we ought to save as many as possible, right? We have the chance to do something simple that spares 4 human lives. Pull that lever, baby, and we'll be heroes. But hidden in this problem, lurking under the surface, are a whole bunch of booby traps. The troubling places that our answer leads us to once the original scenario is even slightly modified. For example, what if we're not the driver, but just an innocent observer, standing next to the tracks where, in this version, the track switching lever is located? Now we don't have the same decision-making responsibilities that we might have if we were employed by the trolley company. Would we still pull the lever then? Or what if the potential smooshies aren't anonymous? What if we look out through the front windshield and recognize our friend Susan standing over there on the other track, and because we don't want to kill our friend Susan, who's so nice and thoughtful and once gave us her Beyoncé tickets when she couldn't use them, we actively decide not to switch tracks? Is it morally permissible to let 5 people get killed in order to save our friend Susan's life? Or what if we see Susan standing there on the other track, but not only is she not our friend, we hate her. She's condescending and mean, and she refused to give us her Beyoncé tickets that one time, even though she couldn't use them. And actually, we were literally just telling our sister yesterday that sometimes we really wish that Susan would be flattened by a runaway trolley. If we pull the lever now, did we do it because we wanted to save 5 lives? Or because annoying Beyoncé ticket-hoarding Susan had it coming? Here's the one that always gets people. What if we're actually standing on a bridge that spans the tracks and we're looking down at the runaway trolley, and next to us is a big, thick-necked weightlifter named Don who's leaning way out over the edge of the bridge? This variation comes from Judith Thompson's seminal 1985 article on the trolley problem. In her version, it's an overweight man. Thick-necked weightlifter just sort of seemed less judgy. We, apparently experts in physics, calculate that Don is just massive enough so that if the trolley hit him, it would slow down and come to a stop before the 5 guys got smushed. Which means all we have to do is shove Don the teensiest bit so he falls onto the tracks and he gets smushed, saving 5 other lives. Would we shove him? Most people draw a line in the sand here and say no, they would not shove poor Don to his certain death. At which point, whoever is administering the thought experiment rightly points out that the action and the result are essentially identical. In one scenario, we pull a lever, in the other, we tip Don off a bridge, but in each case, we are knowingly causing the death of one innocent person to save 5 others. But it feels different, right? I mean, there's got to be a difference between pulling a lever from inside a trolley and physically shoving someone off a bridge. Also, be more careful, Don. Stop leaning so far out over the railings of bridges. None of the people in the trolley problem have any awareness of the dangers all around them. It's infuriating. We're not nearly done, by the way, with thorny trolley problem-related quandaries. What if we're doctors in a hospital and 5 people come into the ER needing 5 different organ transplants, or they'll all die? One of them needs a heart, one a liver, one a lung, one a stomach, one a spleen, I guess. Do you need a spleen to live? It doesn't matter. The point is, they all need organs. We, the exhausted doctors on duty tonight, walk to the vending machine to get a soda, and we see a custodian happily cleaning the floors. Maybe he's singing a little song to himself about how healthy he is and how it's so cool that all of his organs are functioning perfectly. This gives us a great idea. We'll kill that custodian, harvest his organs, and divvy him up. His heart goes to the heart-needing guy, his spleen to the spleen-needing lady, and so on. Everybody wins, except for the custodian. Again, this seems abhorrent, but in essence, it's no different from our action and its results in the original experiment. Because of a choice we make, one innocent person dies, and five innocent people live. Almost none of us would agree to that version, however. It's one thing to pull a lever, we think. It's another thing entirely to sneak up behind a singing custodian and garrote him with a piano wire so we could rip out his spleen. This is why the trolley problem is so compelling. Our answers to the simple question, is it okay to do this, vary widely with each different version, even though the basic act, choosing to kill one person, and its end result, five others live, is always the same. So, what the hell? Utilitarianism, a results-oriented business. We have now arrived at the second of our three main Western philosophical schools, utilitarianism, most famously developed by British philosophers Jeremy Bentham and John Stuart Mill, two deeply weird dudes. Bentham had many admirable qualities. He argued for gay rights, minority rights, women's rights, and animal rights, which were not things a lot of people argued for in 18th century England. He was also, eccentric? And he declared that when he died, his body should be given to his friend, Dr. Thomas Southwood Smith, for use in medical research. Smith preserved Bentham's skeleton, dressed it in one of Bentham's suits, as he had apparently requested, and commissioned a wax replica head when the preservation of Bentham's actual head, and I quote, did not produce acceptable results, end quote. Apparently, in fact, it, quote, went disastrously wrong, robbing the head of most of its facial expression and leading it decidedly unattractive, end quote. The Bentham skeleton wax head contraption is called his auto icon, which I suppose is a better name than nightmare death puppet. And in 1850, Smith donated the auto icon to University College London, of which Bentham was a sort of spiritual founder, though not an actual one, so they took it in. Hilariously, according to the UCL blog, quote, the college did not immediately display the auto icon, much to Smith's disdain, end quote. Seems like a real can-you-blame-them type of deal. For decades, UCL kept their human scarecrow in a wooden cabinet, but in February of 2020, they put it in a freaking glass case in the freaking student center, which I imagine everyone at University College London really enjoys, and it doesn't at all make them want to barf. Here are a couple more fun little tidbits about the auto icon from the UCL Culture blog regarding the rare occasion when they drag it out of its display case.
It takes three people to move, and as Bentham's skeleton is bolted to his chair, it has to be moved in one go. This involves two people carrying the chair and body, while a third holds onto the feet to try to keep them still. The skeleton is held together with copper wire and hinges at the joints, which means in theory the auto icon could move like a living person. In practice, this means that his feet want to stay on the ground or, if held high enough, dangle off the chair. An absolute nightmare when you're trying to move delicately. Another reason why we try not to move it is the fear of pests getting onto Bentham's clothes, eating away and causing huge damage. The undershirt had to be replaced in 1939 because of this, and it has been treated twice for infestations since the 1980s.
So, that's fun. Bentham's disciple J.S. Mill was also an early women's rights supporter, authoring a groundbreaking work of feminist thought called The Subjection of Women in 1869. I read The Subjection of Women in college, and when I started working on The Good Place, I went back and dug out my old copy. I was amused and horrified to see that the cover of the edition we used was pink. You know, because it's about girls. Mill learned Greek and Latin by the age of 8, and by the time he was a teenager, he had an impressive command of Euclidean math, politics, philosophy, and basically everything else, thanks to an overbearing dad who had some truly intense thoughts on childhood education. By the time he was 20, he was horribly depressed, a predictable outcome if you have the kind of father who made you learn Greek and Latin in kindergarten. Mill pulled out of his funk partly by reading romantic poetry, which is a very 19th century British genius way to pull out of a funk, and went on to become one of his generation's most influential philosophers despite never teaching at a university or even attending one. To cap off his singular life, Mill died in 1873 of St. Anthony's Fire, a rare infection where your skin essentially explodes into bright red inflammations. But before his skin exploded, he furthered Bentham's work on the subject of utilitarianism and brought it to the forefront of Western philosophical thought. Utilitarianism is one branch of a school of ethical philosophy broadly called consequentialism, which cares only about the results or consequences of our actions. The best thing to do, says a consequentialist, is simply the thing that results in the most good and the least bad. Specifically, Bentham's initial phrasing of utilitarianism was that the best action is whatever makes the most people happy. The differences in consequentialist branches consist mainly in what the aim or objective is, what they're trying to maximize by making all their decisions. Utilitarianism chose happiness, while other branches may choose kindness or income equality or roasted beet consumption or anything else. I use consequentialism and utilitarianism interchangeably, which would probably get me yelled at in a philosophy PhD program, but again, life's too short. Bentham called this the greatest happiness principle, and it's both invitingly simple and kinda silly. Obviously, Aristotle was also interested in maximizing happiness, but his definition, flourishing by exhibiting virtues in precise amounts thanks to a ceaseless process of searching for those virtues, holds a lot more water at first glance than Bentham just saying, "Hey, let's maximize happiness." Who gets to decide what happiness is would be one question we might ask, given that some people, like me, are normal and well-adjusted, and other people put pineapple on their pizza and enjoy listening to the Red Hot Chili Peppers. Still, consequentialism has undeniable appeal. When I first read about it in college, I thought, cool, I get this one. It's an ethical theory that feels attainable, because all that matters for any action is the outcome. More overall happiness equals better, more overall sadness equals worse. So all we have to do is create more pleasure and happiness than we do pain and sadness, and we win the ethics contest. Consequentialists give us the comfort of knowing that what we did was good or bad, because the answer lies in verifiable results. It's an attempt to take morality out of the abstract and make it more like math or chemistry. Think of the scene at the end of Schindler's List, when Oscar Schindler, played by Liam Neeson, laments that he hadn't done enough, that his gold pin could have been traded or sold, and the money then used to save the lives of two more people. Schindler had found a way to rescue persecuted people using his fortune and influence, so every pfennig he spent equaled some percentage of a human life. His moral calculation was crystal clear, and that's why Schindler's List is famously such a pleasant and relaxing movie to watch. Okay, so only the results matter. But how do we actually judge the results? If you're Oscar Schindler and you trade a gold Nazi pin you don't really care about for two human beings, it's pretty easy to figure out that you created more happiness and pleasure, two lives are saved, than pain and sadness, you don't have your cool pin anymore. But most decisions aren't nearly that cut and dried. If we're going to judge all of our actions on this basis, we need some kind of calculator that can help us determine how many happiness points or sadness demerits each act creates. So, Bentham invented one. He came up with 7 scales we should use to measure the pleasure created by anything we do. Intensity, how strong it is. Duration, how long it lasts. Certainty, how definite it is that it will work. Propinquity, how soon it can happen. Fecundity, how lasting it is or how much other pleasure it can lead to. Purity, how little pain it causes in relation to the pleasure it creates. And extent, how many people it benefits. 2 things are clear. First, it is impossible to hear that list and not make jokes about utilitarianism being like sex. I mean, come on, intensity, how long it lasts, how much other pleasure it can lead to, If you heard that section and did not immediately make a joke about Jeremy Bentham being history's horniest philosopher, you're a better person than I am. But second, this calculator stinks. How are we actually supposed to apply these scales to the things we do? How can we calculate the fecundity of loaning a coworker $20 or the purity of eating a fried turkey leg at a state fair? Bentham even suggested new terminology for our measurements: hedons, for units of pleasure, and dolors, for units of pain. This dude wanted us to walk around and say things like, "By my calculation, buying produce from a local farmer's market instead of a large national chain creates 3.7 hedons and only 1.6 dolors, and thus it is a good action." That just doesn't seem plausible. But Bentham, who, it should again be noted, had his skeleton stapled to a chair and permanently displayed in a famous university, clearly believes in his system, and he writes about it with great conviction. He even made up a cute little rhyme to help guide us.
Intense, long, certain, speedy, fruitful, pure. Such marks in pleasures and in pains endure. Such pleasures seek, if private be thy end. If it be public, wide let them extend. Such pains avoid, whichever be thy view. If pains must come, let them extend to few.
And you know what? Despite all of the problems we've already noted with the greatest happiness principle, that ghoulish human taxidermy experiment had a point. If you knew nothing about morality and all you did was follow Bentham's little rhyme, you'd be a pretty decent person. When we create pleasure or pain, he says, those sensations can be defined by how intense, long, certain, speedy, fruitful, and pure they are. If you're acting only for yourself, go ahead and seek pleasures however you want. But if you're acting publicly, aim to spread as much pleasure around as you can. If you restrained yourself before, I bet you're making the jokes now, aren't you? Avoid causing pain whenever possible, but if you can't, do your best to limit the amount of pain that people experience. That ain't half bad. The main thing that Bentham and the other utilitarians have going for them is their overriding concern for other people and their belief that all people's happiness matters equally. My happiness is no more special than anyone else's, they said, which essentially eliminates the concept of elitism. The utilitarian cruise ship has no first-class section reserved for the wealthiest passengers. Everyone's room is the same size, and everyone eats from the same buffet. So, is utilitarianism the answer? No, utilitarianism is not the answer, in many situations. Unfortunately, any stress test that we perform on utilitarianism can reveal crucial weaknesses in its central tenets. If all that matters is maximizing happiness and minimizing pain, we quickly arrive at some gnarly conclusions, like, say, that a doctor could go ahead and strangle an innocent custodian in order to hand out his organs to 5 needy patients. Bentham's greatest happiness principle also suggests that if a pig has enough pig slop and mud to roll around in, the pig is happier and thus more successful in its life than, say, Socrates, who was maybe a brilliant thinker, but also annoyed everyone in Athens so much that his government threw him in jail and made him drink hemlock and die. Any ethical theory that suggests a muddy pig had a happier and better life than one of humanity's greatest thinkers is in trouble right off the bat, probably. Mill actually devoted a lot of time to correcting the more basic problems in Bentham's work, including this one. He wrote this:
"Few human creatures would consent to be changed into any of the lower animals for a promise of the fullest allowance of a beast's pleasures. It is better to be a human being dissatisfied than a pig satisfied."
Indeed, ever since Bentham introduced utilitarianism to the world, philosophers have absolutely delighted in designing thought experiments to reveal how flimsy it can be. Here's one I like. This is actually a reformulation of a thought experiment invented by the philosopher T.M. Scanlon that I've tinkered with a little because I'm using it in a slightly different context. We'll actually meet Scanlon in Chapter 4. Imagine there's an electrician. Let's call him Steve. Steve is working on a transformer at ESPN during a World Cup soccer match. Steve then slips and falls behind the transformer, just gets really wedged in there, and the electrical equipment starts repeatedly jolting him. We could get Steve free, but doing so would require that we shut the transformer down for a few minutes, interrupting the broadcast. Now, the strict consequentialist makes an easy call here. Tens of millions of people will be so sad if the feed gets cut, so sorry, Steve, you'll just have to stay there and get continuously zapped until your bones are visible through your skin, like in the cartoons. But that answer leaves us cold. It feels wrong to let poor, innocent Steve suffer so that others can be happy. That's what a lot of the problems with consequentialism boil down to, really. Sometimes it simply feels like the conclusion we come to when we tally up the total pain and pleasure resulting from a decision just can't be right. Now, utilitarians had a very clever response to this. If we conclude that some action created more good than bad, but it seems like this action can't possibly be morally permissible, well, that just means we did the calculation wrong. When we're totaling up the good and bad of the action, we have to consider the entire picture. That is, how much pain would be caused not just to the one innocent person who suffered, but to all people who now know that this has happened and that our society has deemed it permissible, which means the same thing could theoretically happen to them. Hearing that we let Steve get zapped like that robber in Home Alone 2 when he touches Kevin's booby-trapped electrified sink just so we could watch a soccer match would thus make a lot of people at least a little bit miserable. So we have to add their psychological and emotional pain to Steve's actual physical pain, which makes the total amount of bad far greater than we at first thought. This is both a brilliant defense and also a total cop-out. Because any time a utilitarian calculation leads to an unpleasant conclusion, the utilitarian can just tell us we did the math wrong. And even if we do factor in the nebulous amount of pain and sadness caused to the world at large by letting Steve be zapped, a consequentialist might still let it happen. I mean, sure, theoretically, everyone now knows that our society permits such things and is thus aware that it may happen to them someday. But honestly, what are the chances this would happen to any of us? We're not electricians. We don't work at ESPN. We might correctly write this off as a freak accident. Plus, Steve must have understood the risks when he took the job of transformer fixer. I mean, all jobs carry some risk, right? So, the strict consequentialist might do a thorough calculation of hedons and dolors and still decide that it's cool to just leave Steve there vibrating like a tuning fork so we can all watch the last 8 minutes of the Brazil-France semifinal. Sorting out these broader, secondary pleasure-pain implications can be a maddeningly inexact science. Here's another problem. Determining the results of our actions requires that we understand the link between those actions and their results, that we actually did what we think we did, which is frequently not the case. If there's one thing people are bad at, it's drawing the correct conclusion from a given result. Well, if there's one thing people are bad at, it's maintaining composure during minor delays in air travel. But drawing correct conclusions is a close second. Often, we do things whose consequences we can't determine for a long time. Sometimes we can't tell the difference between causation, we did this thing, which caused that result, and correlation, we did this thing, and also that other thing happened, but they're not related. Sports fans, for example, often wear a certain jersey or sit in a specific viewing location in their living room because at some level they actually think it helps their team win, which of course, it does not. And yet, I have engaged in these superstitions literally thousands of times. I forced my wife JJ to sit immediately to my right for nearly every game of the 2004 baseball playoffs because the first time she sat there, American League Championship Series Game 4, the Red Sox won. They ended up winning every game thereafter and thus claimed their first World Series in 86 years. So, you know, it worked. Here's a note from Todd.
It was 1996, I believe, when I saw a bunch of Knicks shave their heads before the playoffs, and so I shaved mine. It didn't work.
Follow-up note from Mike. As we were editing this book in 2021, the Knicks made the playoffs for the first time in forever. Do you think it's a coincidence that this happened exactly 25 years after Todd shaved his head? No way. It was because of Todd. Congrats, Todd. It's awfully hard to determine how much good or bad we've created if we don't even truly understand what we've done. Here's an example. Let's say we're trying to achieve some kind of good, like we're teachers and we want our students to get better test scores. To increase their motivation, we tell them that if the average grade on the next math test is above an 80, we'll give them each a prize, one big puffy marshmallow. Now, some of the kids like marshmallows, so they study harder. Some hate marshmallows and they study less. Some are indifferent, so they study the same amount. And some of them are so incredulous at how boneheaded an idea this is, they conclude that their teachers are irredeemable goobers and they have to transfer to another school. So, they study harder than they've ever studied before, and they all ace the test. At the end of the day, the average grade is an 82, and we high-five each other because we think we've solved the problem of student motivation. Offer everyone a marshmallow. Our findings are published in Awesome Teacher Magazine, with a picture of us holding a bag of marshmallows under the headline, "What's Their Sweet Crit?" These teachers know how to get s'more out of their students. We just learned a bad lesson from a good outcome. We think that offering our students marshmallows helped to achieve a greater good, but in fact, they largely achieved the intended result despite our action. And we're now inclined to continue doing something that actually makes us worse teachers. The great majority of human actions involve incomplete information, either on the front end before we do it, or on the back end when we observe the results. So determining the moral value of an action based on the results seems like a risky proposition. And worse, a true consequentialist might not even care that the result was achieved in an unintended way. I mean, we got the result we wanted, so who cares how it happened? If we're declaring an action good or bad based on its results, and the results are often impossible to fully understand, where does that leave us? And doesn't pulling the lever on the trolley seem a bit riskier now? Two more problems for utilitarianism: hedonists and murderous sheriffs. Let's head back to the trolley problem to better understand why we feel differently as we make our way through these variations, even when the big picture utilitarian calculation keeps spitting out the same instructions. Remember that when we approach the original question, we unconsciously respond as utilitarians: saving more people equals good. But should we shove Don the weightlifter off a bridge to stop the train? Well, no, say most people. Why not? Ask the knowing Philosophy 101 professors, springing their trap. You're still choosing to kill one person to save five. Because it just feels different, we reply weakly. What about killing one healthy person and harvesting his organs to save five people who need organ transplants? No way, we say. Doing that would make us feel like we're not even ourselves. Like we're the bad guy in a movie starring Don Cheadle and Rachel McAdams as detectives in search of the infamous utilitarian killer. Cheadle, by the way, plays Detective Steady Eddie Gray, 6 months from retirement. McAdams plays Joelle Joey Goodhart, whose impeccable detective instincts mask a troubled past as a teen runaway. Admit it, you'd watch that movie. I suspect the reason for the inconsistency is somewhat related to those teachers and their marshmallow experiment. The utilitarian who's answering the trolley problem classic might arrive at the right answer for the wrong reason. Maybe it is morally correct to pull the lever and save the five people, but not for the simple reason that five is greater than one. As I mentioned, when Mill and Bentham brought utilitarianism into the world in the 18th and 19th centuries, it drove philosophers batty. Much of the academic world angrily rejected the idea that ethics could be a results-only enterprise. Their critiques are really fun to read, because they're as close as philosophers ever get to trash-talking. If, by the way, they even talked about them at all. Will Durant's 700-page opus The Story of Philosophy, published in 1926, doesn't contain so much as a paragraph about utilitarianism. Bentham and Mill are mentioned only in passing, mostly in footnotes. That is some hardcore academic shade. In 1945, Bertrand Russell, who, as it happens, was J.S. Mill's godson, published A History of Western Philosophy, an impressive survey of everything from the pre-Socratic Greeks to 20th century logicians. And now, with some background information on Bertrand Russell, here is our resident British person, Jamila Jamil.
Russell has the distinction of being one of the most British people who ever lived. His full name is Bertrand Arthur William Russell, 3rd Earl Russell, OMFRS, which stands for Order of Merit, Fellowship of the Royal Society. He was born at Ravenscroft in Trellick, Monmouthshire, an extremely British-sounding place, into an aristocratic family, including his grandfather, Lord John Russell, who'd been the dang Prime Minister of the whole dang United Kingdom. Bertrand also married 4 women: Alice Purcell Smith, Dora Black, Patricia Spence, and Edith Finch, which are all deeply British names for women. This dude was British.
Although Russell was fond of his godfather and found both his intellectual prowess and his deeply moral life admirable, the section Russell wrote on the utilitarians oozes disdain.
"There is nothing new in this doctrine,"
he sniffs, and he later adds that, quote,
"the influence of the Benthamites on British legislation and policy was astonishingly great, considering their complete absence of emotional appeal."
Among his other thoughts,
"there is an obvious lacuna in Bentham's system."
And
"his optimism was therefore perhaps excusable, but in our more disillusioned age, it seems somewhat naive."
And
"John Stuart Mill, in his Utilitarianism, offers an argument which is so fallacious that it is hard to understand how he can have thought it valid."
And
"Jeremy Bentham was an ignorant fool, and should I ever visit University College London, I shall rip off his wax head and fling it into the Thames."
Okay, fine. He didn't write the last one, but you get the idea. He didn't like utilitarianism. He summarizes his displeasure this way.
"Anything whatever may be an object of desire. A masochist may desire his own pain. A man may desire something that does not affect him personally, except because of his desire. For instance, the victory of one side in a war in which his country is neutral. He may desire an increase of general happiness or a mitigation of general suffering. As his desires vary, so do his pleasures."
Russell, whom I imagine writing this section of his book while clenching his fountain pen so hard it eventually snaps in half, touches on a decent point here. The utilitarian focus on total amounts of pleasure or pain makes us think about the potentially massive differences among the people who are experiencing the pleasure and pain. Remember earlier when I mentioned that some people, like me, are normal and well-adjusted, and other people, who are not, enjoy Hawaiian pizza, which, if you don't know, is topped with pineapple and ham? Well, what if I'm running a pizza shop and I encounter you, a weirdo who loves Hawaiian pizza? In fact, you love it so deeply and thoroughly that the amount of pleasure you get from it is just off the charts. One slice of Hawaiian pizza sends you into an orgasmic reverie, just buckets of hedons dripping off your forehead, so that the total pleasure of you eating one slice of Hawaiian is greater than the total pleasure of everyone else eating normal pizza. If I'm being a good little utilitarian, shouldn't I stop making normal, good pizza in order to devote my life to making Hawaiian crime against nature pizza solely to benefit you and create more pleasure? Of course, there would be other calculations here. Would my other customers be sad if I did this? And if so, how sad? Would my pizza place shut down, thus making me and my family sad, and so on? But the important part is this. Don't put pineapple on pizza. It's wet and juicy. Nothing wet and juicy should go on pizza. Honestly, if that's the only thing you take away from this book, I will feel like I've done my job. Utilitarianism often runs into problems like this because human beings, it turns out, are weird. So searching for actions that create the most total happiness can create bizarre situations. It just doesn't seem fair to prefer a ton of pleasure for one Hawaiian pizza-loving sociopath over smaller pleasures for a large number of more decent and stable people who understand that the proper places for ham and pineapple are in sandwiches and fruit salads, respectively. Other times, utilitarians do the reverse, making rules that seem to eliminate the peculiarities of each individual and congeal all of human happiness or sadness into giant clumps. That's hard to swallow, too, given that the differences in what makes people happy are beautiful and interesting. They're the very things that make us us. To some of its critics, utilitarianism isn't really even ethics. It's math. And if someone complains about the result, a utilitarian points to the fact that more people are happy than sad and yells, "Scoreboard!" like a drunk football fan whose team is winning. One of my favorite anti-utilitarian thought experiments, and the one that really helps explain this trolley problem weirdness, comes from Bernard Williams, another British philosopher who designed the following paraphrased scenario.
Williams wasn't quite as British as Bertrand Russell, but he was born in Westcliff-on-Sea, Essex, which is so deeply British it makes Monmouthshire sound like Akron, Ohio.
It's a close cousin of both Steve, the guy who is getting zapped at ESPN, and the trolley problem, but Williams's analysis puts an even finer point on Russell's critique. Jim is vacationing in a small town in some distant part of the country, and he happens upon the local sheriff named Pete, who is pointing a gun at 10 residents. Williams actually uses the pretty standard for 1973 but very offensive for 2022 term, Indians, so I have changed it. It's also pretty offensive that he originally set this scene in a village in South America. A lot of things in the culture become offensive very quickly. More on this later. Pete tells Jim that here in this town, they do a super fun thing to maintain law and order. Every so often, they kill 10 people at random just to remind everyone who's boss. But now that Jim is here, it's a special occasion. So, if Jim agrees, he, Jim, can shoot just one of the locals, and that will serve as the weekly lesson. And before you ask, it's also clear that Jim can't, like, grab the gun and pull some cool Jason Bourne moves on Pete and let everyone go free. For the utilitarian, the solution is obvious. Jim should kill the one local and save 9 lives. But the problem for Williams is that this utilitarian answer ignores Jim. What becomes of a man who is out for a nice walk and then stumbled into a situation where he was forced to murder an innocent person in cold blood simply to achieve some kind of maximal hedon-dolor ratio? How does Jim just go back to his normal life? Williams uses the word integrity to attack the utilitarians, less in the sense of honesty and moral uprightness than wholeness or undividedness. He says that the utilitarian worldview causes a crack in the basic foundation of an individual's being, the sense that, quote, each of us is specially responsible for what he does rather than for what other people do, end quote. 10 people might die because Sheriff Pete thinks that mass murder is a good way to maintain law and order, but that's on Pete. If Jim kills a guy, that's on Jim, even if he does it for the sake of some kind of greater good. Jim's integrity has to matter at some level, his sense of being a holistic entity who's not required to compromise himself by acting in a way that divides him into parts, some of which he won't recognize as his own. Jim has to think it's permissible for him, not just for someone, to shoot an innocent person if it saves 9 others, or to shove a weightlifter off a bridge if it stops a runaway trolley. It might be that the morally right thing to do is, in fact, to kill the one local, but in the utilitarian's mind, it's simply a numbers game, and for Williams, numbers can't be the only factor. We'll come back to the trolley problem in the next chapter and get more explanations for our inconsistent responses. But for now, let's just be content with this notion. When we're confronting moral dilemmas, especially ones where serious pain and suffering result from our actions, relying solely on utilitarian accounting is bound to cause significant problems. There are other factors here, not least among them is our integrity. And ignoring those factors may result in our doing things that we really don't feel are the right things to do. And even if our personal formulation of the right action happens to line up with the utilitarian worldview, that doesn't necessarily mean that the utilitarian worldview is the reason it's the right action. Enough picking on utilitarians. Let's focus on the positives. Most of the thought experiments invented to attack consequentialism involve having to do something awful to prevent something more awful from happening. The best way to exploit the flaws in a numbers game theory is to design scenarios where people suffer no matter what you decide to do. But to let the utilitarians off the hook a little, we should note that their theory often holds up far better when we're simply trying to maximize good. Put runaway trolleys and murderous sheriffs aside for a second and consider a more common real-life situation. Let's say a hurricane damages a city, and a food bank that contains 1,000 meals needs to decide how to divide them up. The utilitarian would simply aim to spread the food around to as many people as possible, starting with those who had been hurt the most by the storm or were in the greatest need, because we would be creating more pleasure by giving those people food than if we gave it to people who were only lightly inconvenienced. That's a pretty good system. The complications arise when you run into those weird pleasure monster requests. Like maybe there's one guy named Lars who claims he should get 100 of the meals for himself because he's composing an emo rock opera based on the movie Avatar that will take months to complete, so he needs a lot of food to keep his creative juices flowing. Well, this is just great. Now the utilitarian has to calculate how much pleasure Lars will get from completing his emo rock opera and how much pleasure other people will get from hearing it. Likely answer, not very much. But even if it were a lot of pleasure, like if Lars is some kind of Philip Glass-type genius whose emo rock opera based on Avatar is going to sweep the world Hamilton-style, one of Bentham's questions relates to how quickly it would